Hello and welcome to the third episode of our new podcast series, When Economies Falter. I'm Harry Moorman, a fund manager at Coronation.
And I'm Seamus Avazy, portfolio manager and analyst at Coronation.
In the first two episodes of the series, we explored the events in a number of different countries where the macroeconomic backdrop deteriorated materially. Countries like Argentina, Turkey, Egypt, and Ghana have all experienced extended periods of countrywide decline. The specific question we ask here in each of these case studies was how differently the asset classes behaved in response to these events in those countries. And what we have seen so far has been fascinating.
Absolutely. So equities preserved wealth in real terms and mostly in external currency terms as well. And that was the primary outcome from all the different case studies we looked at. And this was practically the case in all instances over long holding periods. When it wasn't the case, it was often because the periods that we looked at were shorter in nature, but they tended to come out in the end. In limited instances where equity performance was dominated by holding cash instruments, there were typically exceptional or mitigating circumstances. In Zambia, for example, it was the political decision to not default on local currency debt. And we still don't know whether this is the right answer or not. This is an unresolved question. In Ghana, it was an especially concentrated and skewed equity market that ensured that this wasn't really a representative asset class return at all. In Egypt, an externally vulnerable and challenged country, you know, short-term interest rates were needed to be maintained at particularly high levels to ensure necessary financing and stability. And that enabled the outperformance of treasury bills or cash-like instruments over other asset classes, including equities. But once again, this is an unfinished story. We still don't know where or how or even if Egypt lands.
I've been looking forward to today's episode because after discussing our final case study, we'll be in a position to consolidate our learnings and establish some broad guidelines for investors should they find themselves navigating similar circumstances. Seamus, you've set the final case study in Brazil. Please, will you share your reasoning with us?
Okay, so Brazil is very much a comparator to South Africa for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it always is seen as a case study that South Africa can be compared against for various reasons. Sometimes these are superficial, but sometimes they are definitely valid. But more importantly, is Brazil a valid case study? And I think it is because we've had a period where asset class returns have been upended in the sense that you've had cash and bonds performing as you would expect, but equities underperforming both of these for an extended period of time, which is not what you would expect.
So that is interesting, Seamus, and quite different to some of the other case studies that you've taken us through. So why did equities underperform relative to fixed income and cash?
Okay, so it's very specific to Brazil in this particular instance. So looking at the post-global financial crisis era, so from 2009 up until the present, and you really have to go back a few years to kind of see what happened before that. The answer is essentially an absolutely massive Brazilian equity bubble that built up in the prior years. To give you an idea of how large that was, between 2002-2008, you know, the equity market in Brazil performed by about 50%, not cumulatively, but per annum. So year after year, for an extended period of time, a massive bubble was inflated, which was burst with the GFC. And unfortunately, it was so large, it took a decade to kind of recover from. And so any, you know, initial starting period there resulted in an underperformance from an equity holding for an extended period of time. That was the main reason why equities underperformed. So the second point is that Brazil has very high real rates, and then that's a reason why fixed income assets do particularly well. But we don't know whether this is sustainable or not because it's a very fiscally challenged nation, a lot of unanswered questions, and a lot of people don't think that Brazil will make it in this respect. And so it's a case study that hasn't been concluded yet, and the answer remains very much out there.
Thanks, Seamus. That really was a fascinating case study to conclude with. Before we move on to the guidelines that we promised at the beginning of this episode, let's take a moment to reflect on where we are in South Africa. In the first episode, we mentioned that South Africa was still very far removed from many of these case studies. Why do you believe this to be the case?
That's exactly right, Harry. You know, looking at South Africa relative to all the other case studies, you can see just how different the experience here has been. And that's pretty comforting in the sense that we're nowhere near the kind of asset class upending that you would expect from a country in a significant crisis mode. So essentially, the post-GFC asset return stack in South Africa has essentially been textbook. And by that I mean, if you just look at where things have ended up, everything is in its order and the relative returns are approximately right over cumulative holding periods. So you've had about a cash return that's close to 2% in real terms over an extended holding period. You've had bonds adding an additional 1 to 1.5% per annum. You could argue maybe that's too low for the risk that was involved, but it's the right side of things. The depreciation of the rand has tended to gravitate over the long term between the levels of cash and inflation. And in the SA equity market, of course, lots of volatility, but over long periods of time produced superior long-term returns when compared to other domestic asset classes. So in real returns, you know, just under 6% over the long term, a spread to cash of around 4% per annum. Once again, you can quibble about the absolute equity returns there, but not the relative performance versus what's happened to either inflation or the exchange rate itself. So South Africa is a normal place and has been so for some years. The second big element about South Africa, which was what happens with equity class makeup. And that, by that I mean is essentially, what are you investing in when you invest in the equity market in South Africa? The equity market is very much tilted away from the South African domestic market. So if you look at counters that basically only face inwards and only have direct exposure to the domestic economy, you know, this makes up approximately, depends on how you do it, 10% of the all share. And if you look at big counters that have exposure to other bigger forces in other markets and non-South African economies, well, this makes up, depending on how you measure it, 70, 60, 80% of the market itself. This is important. This is a feature that one needs to bear in mind when one's thinking about long-term asset class performances, particularly under challenged circumstances. So under the scenario where South Africa does face a period of sustained decline, a multi-year sustained decline of stagnation and policy mismanagement to the point of where some sort of crisis may become inevitable, it's not necessarily the case that the equity market will be as exposed as you would imagine. The label says the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, but the contents are something totally different. And I think that's important to bear in mind when thinking about the South African case.
So this really isn't a prediction for what could happen in South Africa, but just looking at what various options might be, given what's happened in some of the other countries where you've done research.
For sure. Not a prediction, but a scenario analysis.
I'd like to wrap up this conversation by looking at how it all ties in together. You've studied 9 different countries in detail. Are there any generalizations to be made? Any guidelines for investors faced with similar decisions?
Well, we think there are. So there are a few broad takeaways from all these case studies, generalizations, if you will, which may be useful if you're looking at something similar in the future. In other words, an extended period of countrywide decline, which, I mean, this can manifest in all sorts of different ways. But remember, we looked at a lot of case studies that had a lot of different features about them. They weren't all the same. They arose from different reasons, and they had a lot of different resolutions attached as well. They were very varied, but there are certain common things that we can take away. The first one, and this is pretty obvious in the sense that we actually haven't talked about this at all yet, but it's worthwhile highlighting at least once, is that when you're faced with periods of significant country-specific decay, the optimal choice will always be in maximizing true, as in jurisdictional, offshore asset exposure on a non-hedge basis. So we've always talked about the kind of the relative performance and how equities tend to do much better than other asset classes, but it's not to say that, you know, the absolute return of equities, particularly in external currency terms, was optimal. In other words, there were definitely other better places to be at the time of the country decline and crisis point. So that is the key number one point, but it's pretty implicit, pretty obvious. More subtly, you know, and we've mentioned this a few times, is that equities are the place to be. They have a strong tendency to outperform over extended holding periods. And that's important here, over long holding periods. So pre the decay itself, pre the crisis point and into the resolution period itself, equities, if you held all throughout the period, almost always outperform other asset classes. This becomes particularly profound when you're looking at episodes where you've seen exceptional currency debasement. This is where, you know, the real linkages with the real economy are much better represented with equities in terms of fundamental value preservation. And in fact, where nominal asset classes get eroded away, there's even a deeper run to exit those and to find safety or some sort of safe harbor in what remains. And these tend to be the equity asset classes.
So that's similar to what we saw in Argentina and Turkey.
That's exactly right. Those are the two best examples of exceptional currency debasement. And you could throw in Lebanon with that as well. But in episodes of persistent stagnation, so perhaps more common or perhaps maybe more probable closer to home, where you have low growth but not corrosive levels of inflation, domestic equities can actually underperform other domestic asset classes for longer than what you'd expect, so longer than cyclical norms. But what you tend to find is that any substantial additional deterioration, whether it becomes through higher than expected or normal inflation or exceptional currency weakness for an extended period of time, that tends to be the point at which equities catch up with your nominal asset classes. And so that's where you see where things get particularly bad, a real inflection point about asset class performance. And then you get currencies with significant external vulnerabilities. So we looked at that in the second episode. And here, there's been a persistent need by these countries, because they're propping up or essentially managing the exchange rate, to sustain very high short-term interest rates for both financing and stability needs. And under these circumstances, what you do get is that an outperformance of cash-like instruments or short-term bonds or anything that are attached to these very short-term interest rates. But it's not to say that this is a sustainable outcome. If a crisis is yet to come, then that all evaporates exceptionally quickly and often in a very dramatic fashion as well, with very large, sudden currency devaluations. And so the bottom line is that only really equities have the potential to be significantly far removed from the hard machinations of a crisis facing a country, a deep crisis. And what you do need to bear in mind, this is what we mentioned at the very beginning, is that that equity composition also makes a difference. So you can be jumping out of the kettle, if you like, and into the fire if you're not facing a suitably diversified equity market.
So your description of some of these severe outcomes reminded me of the first episode where you made reference to post-apocalyptic fiction. And I'd like to revisit the original research article where you wrote about these case studies and where you mentioned this dystopian scenario. I'm going to read a passage in this article as a conclusion to our series. You said that, aside from the cathartic benefits that dystopian fiction provides, there is another parallel here. By working through what a fall into the abyss might look like, it affirms the importance of valuing what we currently have and the need to sustain the struggle to preserve it. And on this note, we've reached the end of our podcast series. Seamus, thank you very much for your insights that you've shared with us during the series. And to our listeners, thank you very much for joining us over the three episodes. We'll be sharing more investment insights in the upcoming podcasts, so stay tuned for more.